Welcome back. The latest episode of the Shamrock. Pete Sampson joined as always by my co-host Matt Fortuna. Today, a name you're probably familiar if you're into bald guys or gambling or watching SportsCenter at midnight. Stanford Steve joins the show. Talk a little bit of over-unders, Notre Dame included, who may be the fourth team in the playoff. And what the heck happened to Stanford? Because that's a program near and dear to his heart that has fallen on hard times. So that'll be the second half of the show. I think you'll enjoy it. Pretty good conversation about kind of on a national level on a bunch of different stuff. But Matt, before we get into that, Notre Dame, couple injuries, Jared Patterson, maybe Cam Hart as well. Let's talk about that. And we definitely need to have, it might be the last word since it came out a week ago. On the Manti Te'o documentary that was out on Netflix. I know we both watched it, and I hesitated to say like I enjoyed it, but I liked it. I thought it was
yes,
interesting and well done.
I agree. Let's go to football first. Big high profile named injuries. The severity of both unclear at the moment. Not the first injury for Jared Patterson this year, unfortunately, after he decided to return for a fifth year, but significant nonetheless. Cam Hart won, you know more about this than I do, but if that guy's anything less than 100% going into this game, that's really concerning for me. And that's not to diminish the importance of Jared Patterson, but that's an offensive line with a lot of experienced bodies and really good coaching there. Cam Hart was, along with Brandon Joseph, the shining stars of this kind of retooled rebound redemption year secondary that's going to get the toughest test he'll probably ever have right out of the gate. So I think he'll play, right?
I mean, I do too.
At least that's the prognosis I think now. That but again,
fine to play.
Anything other than 100% going up against Marvin Harrison Jr., Jackson Smith, and Jigba, that's a little nauseating if I'm a Notre Dame fan right now.
There's no doubt, because I think with Patterson and the foot, the strain, the plantar fascia, like he's casted up right now. I know Marcus Freeman has talked about him maybe being an answer to the bell. I don't anticipate that happening. Not because Jared Patterson is not a tough dude, just like he's got a serious injury. And I think when that hit, you're like, oh man, that's Notre Dame had to run the ball. They had to control the clock. Does this sort of take away from it? And I think it does a little bit. I mean, Patterson is a very talented player. I think that if there's a spot where you can get by, it's probably interior offensive line. I think their two offensive tackles are just absolutely outstanding, and they'll be able to work around it. You can't hide a corner who's struggling or the lack of experience at corner if Cam Hart can't go. And again, I think that he will play. I'm almost certain he will play in the game. I think he may just miss about a week with what I believe is, you know, kind of a hamstring tweak, which he had. I don't know if it's the same hamstring, but was a little bit limited around the bowl game time last year and played. So it they need him badly because we had Bruce Feldman on. Cam Hart was the Freaks List guy. He was, I think, the first Freaks List guy on Notre Dame's roster this year. So he's a lot of great ability there, and they need all of that at 100% at Ohio State. They just do. They can't afford anything less.
Now, Stanford Steve shouts him out later in this episode as well as a fellow DMV guy. I hate to like invoke images that will give fans PTSD, but I think we all saw the importance of a really good corner last time Notre Dame played an elite group of receivers in the Cotton Bowl after the 2018 season.
Oh, yeah.
Were they going to win that game? Probably not, but like they may have had a chance, and Julian Love got hurt and that game was over in 2 minutes of game time. That's why maybe I'm overreacting to Cam Hart's injury, non-injury, whatever it may be. But, you know, I tweeted this excerpt from your story last week about Notre Dame's receivers, and I'll quote it here verbatim. Brady Lindsey led the returning wide receivers with 32 catches for 350 yards and 3 touchdowns last season. Styles is next at 24 catches for 344 yards and 1 touchdown, the score coming in the Fiesta Bowl. The rest of the returners at the position total 9 catches for 124 yards last season. As a point of comparison, Ohio State's Jackson Smith and Jigba put up almost as much production in the Rose Bowl as any of Notre Dame's returning receivers registered all season. That was 15 catches, 347 yards, three touchdowns. And let's not forget, he was their, at best, third best receiver last year. Now, he was number one in that game, but still, I think that's the best position group in the country, Ohio State wide receivers. They've recruited it. They've shown it on the field. Probably not a complete coincidence that all happened when Ryan Day took over and Brian Hartline took over position coach duties full time, because he's a rising star in the coaching business as well. But I mean, that's an elite test. And you've got to be at full strength to even have a chance against these guys.
Yeah, I agree with all that. There's no doubt. All right. Quick final take on the Teo documentary. I get my initial reaction was like, wow, I actually learned quite a bit I didn't know before. I wanted Deadspin held to much more account than they were for the 80% line. But what was really powerful about the whole enterprise to me was, like, at the end, I thought Manti got to say what he had been waiting 10 years to say about how this affected him personally and how he has come out the other side of that. And that was, and I hesitate to say, like, I got emotional watching it, but having covered him and known him only in a reporter player kind of way, it was a very, very powerful moment.
Yeah, I think I texted you the morning after it aired and I said, like, hey, did you watch this? This was actually pretty good. And I say that because, like, personally, I was not looking forward to it. I watch it kind of out of obligation because I covered it in real time. Like, it wasn't something I was dying to watch. I mean, it's been talked about ad nauseum. Me and you have written about it ad nauseum. ESPN had a documentary about a year ago that didn't really reveal anything new. So I just thought, like, all right, here's another one.
What's there to say about it that hasn't already been said?
It was good. Like, it was good. I mean, look, I had similar issues to it that you did, right? I mean, I'm not giving ourselves a free pass here. It wasn't our shiny moment as a established press corps. And Deadspin did break the story, all credit to them. But, like, when you talk about, like, the apology Manti Te'o is owed, I think a lot of that goes to secondhand 80%, like, very shoddy, speculative reporting on a story that otherwise shine a light on something that was purported to be true and wasn't true. But it worked because you had the perpetrator and the victim here. And you got to hear both their sides of the story. I know a lot of people have a lot of reactions to both of them. I don't know how, especially in Teo's case, I don't know how you don't come out of this without feeling any empathy for him. Like, to hear him talk about it, to hear about the effect it had on him as a football player, the place that was his domain where he could get away from everything. It was really, really touching. And to hear the perpetrator side, I mean, again, a lot of people have their opinions on this. I'm not discounting them. It almost, like, made sense of the nonsensical, if that makes sense. Like, it at least, like, gave you a window into how this became a thing and what it was. Like, I remember in real time, I did not know what catfishing was. Like, I was like, what is this? Like, again, I remember thinking in real time, like, if someone had tipped me off to this story at that moment in time, I don't think I would have followed up on it because I never heard of catfishing, nor did I understand the concept behind it. Obviously, there's a lot of personal stuff that Naya gets into here as well. But no, it was, look, I think in the end, no spoilers. Well, maybe a spoiler. Manti Te'o essentially says, I can forgive Naya for what he did to me. I think if Manti Te'o can do it, then the rest of the world can move on as well. But certainly, it was interesting. I liked and I appreciated that they kept the interview list very small, because it's one of those stories where we all had opinions on it and we all had hunches about it. But only two people actually knew what was going on. Like, even, I know I have, I'm sure you have, talked to dozens of Teo's teammates from that year. And a lot of them, I wouldn't say they weren't sympathetic, but a lot of them were like, yeah, he should have known better. Or, hey, like, he never advertised her as his girlfriend to us. It was just a friend, yada, yada, yada. Even in that regard, the Notre Dame voices were Jack Swarbrick, who helped with the response, and Robbie Toma, who's Manti Te'o's childhood best friend and teammate, who knows the guy better than anyone. So I liked how they kept it very tight in that regard.
I agree. And I agree with that. I also think that it was good that an inexplicable story was made, like, oh, okay, it would take these 12 things to happen for this event to occur. And lo and behold, all 12 things happened. You know, not to speak in Stanford Steve's parlance here, but like a 12 team parlay had to hit for the Manti story to take the, you know, go the way that it did. And it did. And I thought that Manti got what it's not what he deserved, but like what he was owed in some ways was the ability to have the last word on it. And I think he finally does. So I appreciate that element of the entire enterprise as well.
It is really crazy looking back on that season, like to your point with the probabilities.
Oh my God.
Like, keep that to on the field. And again, we've written and talked about this a lot. Chuck Martin has told you on the record, we were close, yeah, right? In that story we wrote.
Closer to 3-9 than 13-0.
Yes. And I was with a senior from that team fairly recently, pre-documentary, who said something along the lines of, man, I was glad that was my last game, because if I knew I had three more years of trying to measure up to what an actual champion looks like that we just saw on the field in Alabama, I would not know how we'd ever possibly be able to do that, because that's how much better Alabama was programmatically than Notre Dame, which again, people are going to, Notre Dame haters will take that one day. In my opinion, that shows you how fun and crazy and well-coached and well-prepared that team was that season to turn up with 12 victories with a preseason unranked team and a not very potent offense. So it was crazy. The off-the-field stuff certainly contributed something to that. I mean, I don't know how many times I heard a different version over the years of, Manti's out of position on this play. And up, he got an interception again. What do you know? Like, things are just breaking our way this year. It was a weird year, and it was fun from a football standpoint to relive that year and all the craziness that came with it, especially because Notre Dame had not been a very good football program in the two decades prior to that. So it's easy to forget about that now. The story itself was crazy. I don't know about you. I much like in real time when it happened, I heard from a lot of people I don't normally talk to who are watching that, who aren't even sports fans. We're like, oh, hey, didn't you cover this? Like, this is crazy. Like, what do you remember? Like, it was interesting in that regard. It wasn't something I was necessarily looking forward to. But again, I think the documentary itself did a pretty good job of not sensationalizing anything, of keeping the facts as kind of bare and plain for all to see as humanly possible, and getting the two main voices in there. So in that regard, again, I went in with very low expectations. I came out pretty darn impressed with the production as a whole.
I think like one of the elements that wasn't featured in there, and it was fine that it wasn't, was like what a circus 2012 was around here. How, and I was trying to explain this to somebody over in the Goog who wasn't around at this time, explain it like, because the question was like, how could you not push back on this or like check it at the time? And I was like, every press conference that fall began with some version of talk about the excitement as the first question. And like, I sort of got it. And like, we joke about that now and it's like, oh, 3-0. But like, once it got to like the Oklahoma game and then you get out of the Pittsburgh game a week later, you're like, holy shit, this is happening. And it really, I've never covered a season like it in 22 years. I will never cover another season like it in the next 22, assuming that I'm still around. But it had every, like, there's nothing more joyous than like if you're a fan of a team, than having unexpected success out of nowhere after you've waited 25 years to have it. And there was just so much mojo around Notre Dame at that time. It's just people got drunk off it. I think some people in the media did as well.
Yeah, I mean, two things. One, I mean, I don't think a season like that can happen in college football in the playoff era, where a team legitimately, I mean, again, maybe if Kansas State goes undefeated, Notre Dame plays Kansas State in the title game, and maybe Notre Dame goes from preseason unranked to national champion. Like, that can't happen in the playoff era. But like, people genuinely believe they had a chance to win that Alabama game. So like, I think we've all been a little jaded by the playoff era where it's the same couple teams every year. So from a football standpoint, that's correct. The other part, I mean, yeah, I mean, like, look, hindsight's 2020. I specifically remember when the story of what, I'm getting the names all confused here, the fake and real names, Lene died. It was, I don't know if it was a message board or what, but like, it was something where like Brian Kelly got asked about it, I think on the Thursday press conference before the Michigan State game, like, hey, will Manti play this week? And it was like, what happened? And I remember speaking to people in the program. They're like, yeah, we think it was just a friend of his. We don't know. But like someone close to him died. Like it quickly ballooned, you know, 2 days later, post Michigan State to like, just my girlfriend, yada, yada, yada. Obviously, the thing took on a life of its own. I also specifically remember asking Brian Teo, Manti's dad, who, like a lot of us, I'm sure, got pretty close with throughout that season because that family was a quote machine. Hey, we have not, I'm doing a story on Manti and his season. We have not heard from the Kekuas. You've sung their praises to me and others. Would you mind making that connection? I'd love to talk to them and hear their perspective on how their late daughter's boyfriend is playing this season for her. And he said they'd like to remain private. And again, that's fine. Like,
you're not normally talking at face value, right?
Like, if you're not talking to the press in general, like, you're not a public figure. And if you just underwent what was purported to be a human tragedy, yeah, you're probably less inclined to get on the phone with a stranger than otherwise. So I didn't, again, in retrospect, yes, that's a red flag, but like, it wasn't something in real time where I'm like, well, something's up here. Like, I haven't seen the death certificate yet. So yeah, I mean, that's part of it. The other part, I don't think this has been brought up, and look, it's already been such a crazy story. I don't think it's too crazy to throw this potential wrinkle in there. He finds out at the Heisman ceremony. It comes out about a week after that title game. Can you imagine if that Deadspin report or any other report exposing this came out before that Alabama game? The circus that would have been?
No, nor do I want to.
I can't comprehend it because it was already beyond comprehension when we thought it was real and they were in the title.
We already hammered the media hospitality room at the BCS National Championship game that year. It just would have been obliterated. Like, I think we would have drank that entire county dry in Fort Lauderdale if we had to cover that on top of the game itself. Never mind the fact that Notre Dame's head coach interviewed for the Eagles right immediately after the game. So that was another fun little wrinkle of that time and place.
I specifically remember, so that happens right after the game. My grandmother, diehard Notre Dame fan, actually died right after the game for real. I can show you the death certificate if anyone's questioning me. So I take a few days off for her funeral. My first day back, I think it was Brian Hamilton on the beat who texted me saying, hey, I think Deadspin's about to drop a story here that's going to make our lives very, very complicated. And again, you think about all the bad crap that happens in college sports and all the weird stuff we'd covered in the year or two prior to that in Notre Dame. And I had a million different scenarios going through my mind of what that story could be. Catfishing, fake dead people was not among them. And even then it was like, because, you know, they interviewed Dr. Phil and the thing, Katie Kirk, the cringy questions and exchanges there. I remember a group of us, I'm sure you were in it, the beat was much bigger at the time. Maybe 3 weeks after, we're on like an email or text chain. We're like, all right, so when can we stop writing about this? Because he doesn't play here anymore. No laws were broken. No NCAA rules were violated. We think we know all we need to know now that Renaya has gone on Dr. Phil. Like, is this not a story anymore? When's it not a story? Because it's still all anyone wants to ask us about and talk about. And it just kind of slowly died down, but it was crazy. There'll never be anything like it. It really won't.
No. And hopefully that nothing even comes close to challenging it. We'd all be in a better place if that was the case. All right. Let's skip another interview with Stanford Steve on all things over under wins, Notre Dame, and why Michael Mayer could beat up Brock Bowers and perhaps even more than that. So Stanford Steve is next. Thanks for being with us on this episode of the Shamrock. Definitely keeping in line, getting back to before the show, Fortuna said, getting back to our roots, which is just a little too on the nose for a bald reference.
Did not intend it that way, but yeah, sometimes so, the world aligns.
This podcast is called The Shamrock. Originally, we wanted to call it Domes on Domers, and management vetoed the idea. But Steve, thanks for joining us. Hopefully, you feel comfortable talking to a couple bald guys, one of them who is tall and skinny and wearing glasses. So I hope this is a comfortable place for you.
Yeah. It's funny, Pete. Every time I'm at a game and you're there, I got to do a double take because I'm like, wait, I thought Scott wasn't traveling and I'm here for the show. So, no, it's great. I appreciate you guys thinking of me. Matt, you and I go back a long time. Pete, your work with what you've started and kept on doing is awesome. I don't think anybody does it better when it comes to Notre Dame. So I do think a lot of you guys for having me on, for sure.
We'll start with Notre Dame. You had on our last guest, Bruce Feldman, on your show last week, and you may have unintentionally declared yourself the president of the Michael Mayer fan club, a guy who is not one of Bruce Feldman's freaks, but who is a freak in his own right and will probably break a lot of records this year for Notre Dame. What do you see out of him this year, and as a position near and dear to your heart, where do you put him, not just this year, but in recent history, is far as what he could potentially do this year among the tight end position?
Well, I declared myself the president of Mayer fan club like 3 years ago when I first saw the kid. I was just blown away, and then just talking to people with the program, you couldn't find a bad word about the kid, man. Whether it's helping guys at his own position, whether it's taking more on in a responsibility role, or whether it's just flat out going out in the field and producing, man. There were some lean offensive situations, I thought, for Notre Dame last year, when the injuries happened and they got to go young. I go back to the Purdue game. I mean, it wasn't pretty with Carl, having to deal with Karlaftis with two young guys and Mayer still there as that rock for the, the Dora quarterbacks. When health arisen for Cohn. So I love watching him every single week. He brings something different to the table. He's so versatile that's why I'm confident in Notre Dame this year, because, he could line up everywhere. And now what everybody does and that what Notre Dame has done is, I call it the Kelsey with the Chiefs, is they'll go 3-by-1 and in the tight end, Mayer or Kelsey will be that one receiver. So it's like, all right, how are you going to go 1-on-1 with this guy? Or are you even going to take it out? And I think that's the things when I think about formations where I think Tommy Reese is so good, is that they can use that to their advantage to help maybe where they don't have an advantage. You know what I'm saying? Like in the run game, if they could get another guy out of the box, I think they got to run the ball more this year. So I look at them being able to formation people, knowing how good and how valuable Mayer is and what other teams think of him. So I think the world of the kid, I really do.
All right, imagine the scenario. We lock Michael Mayer and Brock Bowers from Georgia in a cage together. How quickly does Mayer kill Bowers and escape from the cage?
I've gone back. I've gotten myself in trouble with my I have a lot of friends down in Athens, and I've said Michael Mayer is the best tight end in the country.
This is what I go on any radio show I go on south of Tennessee. This is what I say, just to like as a trial balloon. Like, how does this sound to you guys? Because this is the truth.
And here's what I'll say is I know Georgia's got the best tight end room. In my opinion, I think they have the best tight end room. But when you talk about having guys do all the dirty work, like, Darnell could do some stuff. They got Gilbert back to help, maybe keep Brock a little more fresher for those go routes or those short ones that he busts out. Mayer doesn't have that. I love Big Mitch. I'm excited to see what he brings to the table this year for the Irish. And but you're not getting me to take anyone over Michael Mayer in a 1-on-1 steel cage match.
I'll just say that. His team is a 15.5-point underdog right now, according to BetMGM at Ohio State, over under 58.5. Obviously, that's a high line. I think even the most diehard of Notre Dame fans would be happy to, or at least content to, get out of there with a impressive loss, for lack of a better term. Do you see a path to victory for Notre Dame in this game? And if so, what is that path?
Well, here's the problem I have is, I thought Notre Dame, I think Notre Dame, where they could do is cause some disruption with their defensive line and their front seven. The problem is that I think Jimmy Knowles is the perfect hire, because when I think about Ohio State, everybody's going to talk about what he's going to do with the defense. I think he's so demanding and such a good coach, he's going to help the physicality of the Ohio State offensive line. So that's where I feel like when I first thought about it, Notre Dame, I'm like, all right, they could hold their own, you know, maybe not be able to let Stroud take those deep drops for those double, triple moves that Smith and Jigba and those guys love to do. You know, I go back to the Minnesota game last year. You know, Ibrahim gets hurt. They're rolling, and then they just wait it out. Ohio State waits it out. And Day, I think, is the best play caller in the sport. I really do. He has his foot on the gas constantly. But I think, going back to it, I know the injury to Pettersson, and there's hope there, talking to people. And, I mean, you guys have covered it too. But I do think they're going to be improved with the Notre Dame secondary. Now, is there going to be a couple hiccups? Yeah, that's what Ohio State does to you. You can't, you know, bend but don't break that. That's not going to work, because then they'll take whatever they want. And the running back's a complete player in himself and Travion Henderson. So, obviously, you got to play well too. And that's what other thing in these circumstances with that I think happens. Notre Dame, it's happened. And when they got into the playoff, they haven't played well in those games. And you don't have a chance if you're not going to play well there. So I think they're not going to be afraid of anything. They've seen guys. I do think they're going to have a different approach, obviously, defensively, than they had against Oklahoma State in the bowl game also. So I think it's going to be more buttoned up. I think running the ball is going to be a priority. And then, you know, put a little onus on Ohio State. It's not like these guys became, you know, NFL players overnight. There's going to be a process. Obviously, you hear all the stuff out of Columbus that their defensive ends are going to have a lot better year. Well, they better, because these are, I think it's two of the last three seasons are the worst scoring defenses in the school's history. So they're going to be improved, but I'd rather get Ohio State week one, I think, than week seven, you know, or later. So, how much is going to be on Buckner's shoulders? Are we going to have some design QB runs on third? And, you know, can you keep third downs manageable? That's where I think, and that's why I like Tommy Reese. I trust him in his play calling to get his team in the best situation. He plays to his strengths all the time, and that's why I do give them a shot. I know everybody's asking what's the bigger blowout, Ohio State or and Notre Dame or Georgia and Oregon. I think it's more so on the other side, because I do feel like Notre Dame's seen elite players and teams before, and they're not going to be wowed by anything. So I think that they have the goods to definitely make it a game.
I think a lot of this offseason, I've sort of looked over the Michigan game and the Oregon game last year for Ohio State. Like, okay, what are some common denominators there? I think Michigan is like sort of an outlier. That's like, that was a cathartic religious experience for Jim Harbaugh and that entire fan base.
No doubt.
Oregon seems like a lot more like, okay, if Notre Dame can replicate something, it's what Oregon did. And like, you know, big plays offensively. But for me, the big thing, and I was curious your opinion on this, is like Oregon's offense put pressure on Ohio State's offense in the sense like they had to go for it three times on fourth down, missed all three, one in each quarter to start the game. Do you sort of see that as like a sneaky factor? Like Tommy Reese has to give Ryan Day something to think about. It's like not Al Golden, Jim Knowles. It's how does Reese sort of make Day think about, all right, do I go for it here? Do I have to get more aggressive than I want to actually be?
Yeah, and I don't think Tommy's ever been afraid to pull the trigger when they need a big play. But you can't have to do that every series. Yeah. You know, and that's why I think Buckner with his legs, I think Tommy's smart enough to keep those third down and manageable, because now you stack a couple third downs together and convert, or just move the chains on first and second down. Now game's shrinking, right? And now the pressure's even on more Ohio State on their offense. And yeah, Notre Dame's had some busts in their secondary. But like I said, it's not like they haven't seen guys that are good. Is this the best receiving core in the country? Probably, yeah. But Notre Dame has guys that have seen that. And, you know, I think about a kid from down here in D.C. and Cam Hart. Like, I'm expecting a big year from here. I mean, I look at that guy in his uniform. I mean, he looks like a Greek god when he comes out with the jersey, you know, over the belly button and everything. So I think those guys would be fired up. It's amazing what Ryan Day could do messing with DB's eyes too, though. And that's where I think Notre Dame has to be disciplined. And it's the one thing I feel like, you know, I keep saying, you're not going to see what you saw from Notre Dame defensively against Oklahoma State. It's just not going to happen with Golden coming in. And this is the third DC for Notre Dame in 3 years, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think Marcus is going to spend plenty of time making sure they're buttoned up, because the one thing you'll always realize, and that's why I say it blows my mind when there are so many mental breakdowns on defense, when you're on the road, it's quiet usually, right? They want to be quiet for the offense. So your defense has got to get your checks right. You got to make sure you know what coverages you're in and all that stuff. So I do think Notre Dame has the veteran guys to be able to be in what they're supposed to be, which is the starting of all this, right? Because that's where Ryan Day can start messing with you and messing with the liabilities, if you have any, on defense.
I think it's a very plausible scenario, and I'm not saying this will happen, but Notre Dame gets boat race in week one and goes 11-1. I can absolutely see that happening because yep. Ohio State might be the best team in the country this year.
No,
that said, the over-under for Notre Dame is 8.5, which is,
yeah.
I think it was 8.5 last year. They went way over that. Now you've got -150 juice on the over here. What do you think? I mean, I think it's easy to take for granted that Brian Kelly won every single game as a favorite over the last 4 or 5 years and did a great job of winning the games you're supposed to win, and you just don't have that guarantee with a first-year head coach. Which way are you leaning when you look at that schedule and you see that number?
I brought it up on my podcast last week. I could see them running the table after that game. I really do. I look at two games that I don't know what's going to happen, and that's North Carolina and BYU. Those are the two games where it's possible. Like, North Carolina goes to Boone, and then they go to, like, Atlanta to play Georgia State. And that's just weird to me. And now they named May the starting quarterback. Mac Brown says he doesn't have a plan for the quarterbacks, but I don't believe him when he says that. So what is North Carolina going to be? Could they bust out offensively with all these guys they've gotten and you know, score a ton of points? Could they be favored in that Notre Dame game? I don't know. And what's Notre Dame going to look like out of this game? Because when you start thinking about it, it's the physicality of Ohio State and knowing how many guys they could run at you, right? Like, you know, I hear you guys talking about Notre Dame's depth and what are we going to have left on the defensive line? What's the linebacker core look like? And that's where you think about it's tough to project, and that's what makes it so fascinating is what are they going to come out of week one looking like? Is everybody going to be intact? Because if they are, they'll be good to go. They're going to learn so much about what they have. And I think Marcus Freeman did that in the bowl game. And I think he's going to even do more so of that after week one to assess things. Like, if there was competition for places, hey, let's get these guys in if the game is a multiple score game and see what we got so we have some tape on them. And then it's a teaching tool. So I think Notre Dame is really looking forward to seeing what they have as a whole in week one. And then when you go down the schedule, yeah, Clemson is going to be Clemson, but what is it guaranteed they're going to be better? Like, is there a switch that DJ put on at QB? I don't see that. I think they're going to try and run the ball more to take more pressure off them for sure. But I think all the games are gettable. I still think UCLA and Utah should be considered the favorites for that Pac-12 South with all the hype SC's getting in. I know SC is getting offensive line guys back, but there's a serious depth issue. And, you know, you guys have talked plenty about offensive line depth issues. SC has plenty. And I'm fascinated to see what SC is coming out of September. You know, they go to Stanford. It's a home game for SC there. And then they go to Corvallis, which has always been a tricky spot. And I think Fresno is the best team in the Mountain West. So I think that's going to be their toughest game. I think Fresno could actually beat them. So I think down the schedule, Notre Dame's, I mean, they consistently get better as the season goes, as good teams do. So running the table, probably best scenario after Ohio State, yes. But I definitely think 9-3 at the least.
All right, a team and a program near and dear to your heart, Stanford, over under 4.5. What's happened to the Cardinal? It was really one of, like, an underrated great rivalry in in college football 10 years yeah. ago, and it really has sort of fallen off on the Stanford side of things. How what's happening there?
Well, what happened in you know, what's funny is we talk you guys brought up Brock Bowers and how the hell did he get to yeah. Georgia from Napa? And when you talk to people down there, his parents basically said, all right, we can't do anything in California. We're going on a road trip. And they went all the way down to Atlanta and Athens. And that's how they got lucky and kept it pretty quiet. And the kid loved the place. And when you that's what I think about with Stanford is the lockdown. Guys, I mean, they did a camp and then they had to go back home. They didn't have any like after the season, they cut it short. The kids didn't want to go to a bowl game because they were so tired of being on lockdown. And I mean, you guys have been there. I went there. It's the best. It's the best looking campus there is in the country. And when you can't bring people in, it's really a problem because seeing that place and what the capabilities are, whether it's, you know, being close to Silicon Valley and San Francisco and that area of the country, it sells itself. It really does. And it blew me away when I went there on my visit. So that, I mean, it was almost 2 years where they couldn't bring recruits on campus. Mm-hmm. I think, and then when you factor in the recruiting that they struck out on and the guys that haven't produced, that's a bad mix. When you talk about a numbers game and you're still trying to get the 85 scholarships where everybody else could just bring in guys to fill it from the transfer portal. So now they finally had a full year. That's normal. I do think a lot of Tanner McKee, I think he's a really good quarterback. The receivers are back to what Shaw likes, the big physical guys, the offensive line. I mean, the run game, that's the problem, is they can't ever get any movement on the offensive line, and the defensive line is just atrocious. They were last in the Pac-12 in rush yards given up last year. I still trust David Shaw. I do. I know plenty of people are asking what his job is, and it's Stanford's not like these other blue bloods, yep. you know, like they're going to remember the success they had. So I do think a bowl game is gettable for Stanford this year. I do. I think more so than ever, health is a serious issue when it comes down to injuries, knowing the lack of depth they have. They got a good recruiting class coming in next year, which hopefully they can keep going forward. But those Pac-12 North teams, I don't think anybody's that good. I mean, I think you have half the division has first-year coaches. So I think Stanford has a little more stability than those teams. So I think a bowl game is definitely gettable for them this year.
I'm not sure, much like it was at Notre Dame, I'm not sure there's a bigger gap between perception and reality than there is with Brian Kelly. Whether it was all the good things he did at Notre Dame, the way he exited, all the weird things he said at LSU, but what he usually does behind the scenes. 6.5 for LSU. I mean, I know there's a lot of juice on that overside, but to me, that just seems like selling Brian Kelly and that blue blood of a program short. I know they're not anywhere near the level they'll be at 2-3 years from now, but how do you see the Brian Kelly experiment long-term working out in Death Valley?
I like it. I've talked to plenty of people down there and have a bunch of friends down there, and they always, you know, they love the Orgeron hire because it was a fit, you right. know, because he was from there. And people have said that, and I could be stealing it, but a good fit, you know what makes a good fit? Winning. And Brian Kelly's won, you know, at Notre Dame. And when I'm biased because I trust him as a head coach. I really do. And I think he gets it done. When you look at that roster, there's a lot of capability there. I would probably take their wide receiving group right behind Ohio State when it comes to all the groups in the country. I do think they're that talented. So that's why I think the quarterback situation is going to be handled correctly. I look what he's done going back to what was it, Caleros and Tony Pike at Cincinnati and the way he wheeled and dealed at Notre Dame. Like, he's always gotten them in the right situation. But I just think of a structure and a stability. You know, this week came out, there's guys with academic probation issues, and that's Brian, I think, putting his foot down saying this is how things are going to be done. They do have probably the best pass rush in the conference when you look at guys that are coming back. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of turnover in that. Like, Ole Miss is a team, I don't know what the hell they're going to look like. And they have a really manageable schedule. They could go 7-0, and Lane could look like a genius. You know, I just think of him like as the best daycare teacher in college football because he just keeps bringing guys in. and they produce. And, you know, he loses both coordinators now, and he plays it off in his press conference. But he has done a great job of bringing guys in, making them feel comfortable. But I think LSU definitely wins seven. I will say this. If they don't win the opener, they're not going to go over their season win total, I don't think. I think it's a huge game for them. I call it a home game in New Orleans against Florida State, but I look at his one. He said you got to run the football in the SEC West. I believe he's going to do that, and that'll handle a lot more things offensively and defensively. They've done a bunch of work in the portal too, but yeah, I think the only side to play is over 6.5 with LSU.
Well, it took Brian Kelly 7 years to figure out you had to run the ball in South Bend too to win. But I'm glad that he took that lesson from up here and brought it down there. It's really important. I was interested, like we're sort of throwing teams and over unders at you. What when you sort of look at nationally,
yeah,
are there over unders where you're like, oh man, I love that?
Yeah, they're just not the sexy teams.
Yeah.
I have a saying where when it comes to a season win total, I want to get it over as fast as possible. So like I was looking at Northwestern. There's no way Pat Fitzgerald's going to be as bad as he was last year. Like you talk about having a trust in a guy and a coaching staff. Yeah. Like that line's up to 13 now week one. And I go back to what Nebraska looked like week one last year. I think the seniors that Northwestern has, they probably got maybe the best left tackle in the country. They got the running back back. It's just a quarterback situation. I mean, they had Ramsey for the COVID year, but since Thorson left, they just haven't been able to get consistency there. But I think there are games there that are gettable. I don't like what I've seen out of Bloomington. I would take the under with the Indiana Hoosiers. And same thing with Michigan State. I don't think you could just plug and play year after year. And I've stated that Mel has violated the transfer portal. And I just don't think that's sustainable because at some point you're going to need some depth. And I think that's where people are going to realize a transfer. Every guy, when you read these previews, yeah, we've used the portal to find a position where we need, stability or we need a starter. And that's going to catch up with you because now you're not filling out your roster the way you should be. So I think the weight is going to go towards the transfer where it should be, hey, let's take a guy, redshirt him, and then he's our offensive lineman moving forward. So that's all these season previews. It's just trying to keep who's where and how long do they have. Are they going to leave again? Like, that's the other thing. You got guys, Maryland here had a guy leave to go to Kansas State, and now he's at UCF. So there should be some accountability for these players, but, I mean, it's the Wild West, it feels like, with guys moving around. So I look at that. I do I'm trying to think of a top 10 team I like. See, to me, I think everybody's playing for one spot because I think Georgia has enough to get back. So I have Georgia, Ohio State, and Alabama in the playoff. And now I'm just trying to figure out who the hell that fourth team is going to be. So that's why I'm still diving in and trying to check some depth charts. I don't think Utah has no chance of going over their season win total if they lose week one at Florida.
They're not going to lose that game, are they, though? I think that's my favorite week one line. I just don't see how the Utes –
I hate giving a couple points on the road. And when you talk about an environment like Florida, I like the under there this year. I love the hire of Napier. I just don't think that roster is that good right now. And I saw he had a quote last week or over the weekend. He said Anthony Richardson has 33 pass attempts in his career, and most Florida good quarterbacks here have 33 touchdowns in a season. So, we talk about stability with Billy. I like moving forward. He's going to do fine recruiting moving ahead. This is a tricky year, obviously, with all that's going on and when it happened. But I don't know. I feel like every time being a Pac-12 guy, I always find this is a huge spot because I was saying there's three games early on. Notre Dame falls into this. Notre Dame, Ohio State, Oregon, Georgia, Utah and Florida. And then Texas and Alabama. When you look at those four, those games are going to be held against those teams all year. You know, Notre Dame, they could be running the table, as we pointed out, possibly. That Ohio State game is still going to be what everybody goes back to. And Texas, can they hang around with Alabama? Because I have no idea what they expect in the Big 12. No one, I mean, just going through, it feels like everybody played 7 one-score games last year. So could Texas, you know, when these narratives start being formed, can Texas compete and have that good perspective, you know, that perception of people like, yeah, I watched that Alabama game. They got the goods. They should get the benefit of the doubt when the playoffs, you know, comes around. Because their team, I think if they get out of that game healthy, they could run the table with the offensive power they have. So it's a tricky spot for Utah. And another thing is, whenever the Pac-12 gets in these situations, aside from Oregon, Ohio State, it never works out for the Pac-12. And that's what's really, really hurt the perception of the Pac-12, is they can't get these wins in the out of conference. And it's not going to change, I don't think, until they start getting these wins.
To your point, I'd like to know the last Power Five team that came out of an Alabama game intact. Like, it feels like they broke Florida State's program.
The limb
2017. They broke Miami.
Look at Miami last year. Like, it took them 2 months to get back on track, it felt like.
USC, I think it was when David Cutcliffe retired at halftime of the game when they played. Yeah, it's only because Vanderbilt is the unofficial second college football program of the show, and the head coach is a friend of our dear podcast here. I don't know if you have any feeling of where the Clark Lea and the Fighting Commodores may be headed in year two there.
It can't be worse than last year, right?
No, it can't. You know, like, definitely can't.
It can't. So
they lose to Hawaii this week. They might
it would still be better than losing at home to East Tennessee State.
No, I and that's what I say. I look at, like, getting these things over with. You know, if you have the Vandy over and you lose on the island this week, you're not getting there. You're not getting there. So if you want to, you know, you got a little juice, you could. That one could be over by the end of September, I think. With the scale, all you need is three. You get one, and then you need two more. I don't think they're going to win a conference game. So those out of conference games are pretty important for the old Commodores.
It's funny. I remember last year, Kansas over under was one. They opened Friday night with an FCS team, and I thought, you're not going to lose this, right? Even though the juice was really big, and I think they barely won it, and they ended up being Texas. I did not place that bet, but you live and you learn. You talked about teams that are replenishing through the portal and relying on the portal maybe a little too much. Who are the teams like the Wake Forest of the world that have kind of gone the opposite way, that might have a little more unity, for lack of a better term, that will allow them to punch above their weight and probably be better than they should be based on the talent on the roster and the star rating?
I'm a believer in NC State. I think, you know, people want to talk about culture, and I saw they had the least amount of guys enter the portal. I think they had 7 and none of them were on the two deep. They get their whole two deep back. In the last, I want to say 5 years, they're second in the conference behind Clemson. And when I think about NC State, and Doran's kind of a quirky dude. You talk to people that played for him at Wisconsin, and, you know, I don't think they would go out with him, you know, for a beer, but they respect the hell out of him as a coach. And that's fine. You know, if I always say players should go want to play for their head coach. And that's where the dynamic of these guys leaving and all that, that's a whole nother conversation for another day. But I look at NC State's schedule, and I also think about the offseason they had. Guys, when that game got canceled the day of against UCLA in that bowl game, if they won that game, they had a chance to be the second team in school history to win 10 games. That leaves a bad taste in your mouth. And I think they've had a great offseason. I think that's a team that knows that everything is gettable. You know, people could say what they want about Clemson. NC State still did beat them last year. And Dabo's, you know, still say they have 10 wins. So I look at Clemson the same. But I look at NC State, the quarterback dynamic in that league is pretty fascinating to me, because if people are going to say Clemson is going to be, you know, the best team, I think there's 6 quarterbacks I would take over DJ in that conference. I really do. And Devin Leary's one of them. They got to figure out some things at running back, but I'm not really worried about that. The defense should be a a strength to the nth degree. They get guys back that didn't even play last year that were all conference guys the year before. They do have a tricky game at East Carolina. Like, I was looking at the time of day that game was, because if that was a night game, I think that takes on a whole nother level. But East Carolina will be ready. They got a ton of guys coming back. I think Houston's done a good job there. But I do think NC State, they do get Clemson, but I see double-digit wins for them. I really do. I like Leary. I think he's great in pressure situations too. And that's when I look at these quarterbacks, like, hey, what's this guy do when the game's on the line at 2 minutes? Or when I need a score, what are they doing? And he didn't turn the ball over much at all. And that's another factor why I like NC State. I believe in what they've built there, and I expect a big year from them this year.
It's kind of a pivot to a different line of questioning, like off college football, more on the show that you do with Scott. And to me, it's like very unique in a very loud and sometimes obnoxious sports media space. So like, why does that show work as well as it does? Cause like, it seems to me, it feels unique in sort of not just college football space or college athletics, but just like sports in general.
Well, it's pretty simple. We started this week. This is our eighth year already doing the Scott Van Pelt Sports Center. And all the credit goes to him. He said we were going to do certain things, and we've continued to do them. He said we were going to do bad beats, and we tried doing it on the radio show way back in the day. And the visual, I think, is what blows people away of being able to see this stuff. And, you know, last night we did bad beats. We had a soccer game that the over was 2 and it was 1-0 and 2 own goals in the 90 plus minute come in. And you're just like, but to see that and be like, guys, it's not your goal and you gave it up and now the over is all messed up. But anyway, he said he was going to do what he wanted to do. And that's why we haven't gotten into having on multiple panels and talking about this topic. We come in, we meet at 4:30 on a Zoom, we throw all the ideas against the wall. Scott brings his ideas to the table, and then it's a process to move him forward. And his name's on the show, and we do what he wants to do. And that's why he's the best in the business, because what he brings, I feel like, is an interesting perspective from him, but also what people want to see. Whether it's a feel good thing or a tough story to do, we're going to do those things and not be afraid of them. And we're going to have Scott's twist on it. So it's all him. He's the face of it. And that's why it's good, because it's him and it's his.
I think, at least for me, that soccer game, great example. Like, I didn't follow it. I wasn't betting on it. The minute I see that segment come on and I see the time and the score, I immediately get like physically nauseous just knowing that someone lost a lot of money on this, which is why it's such a great, great segment. What's the most memorable, I guess, in the bad beat in the college football space, excluding the Cincinnati Duke Belk Bowl that you guys lead with a lot, as the intro to the segment?
I still think it's Abilene Christian in Virginia. It's made its way onto our montage. Virginia was up a ton, and they were given, I forget the score, but they're up a ton and they're backed up in their own 5-yard line. And I, from the stories that I gather, they had a mix up in the wristband of what the play was going to be. And they attempted to throw a double pass in their own end zone. So they get a safety, and then Abilene Christian gets the ball and scores against all the bad guys for Virginia. So now it's in flux. And then Abilene Christian has the ball again, and they throw a pick six on the last play of the game. And it's just like all these things that happened were just incredible, because there was a celebration penalty on Abilene Christian for scoring a touchdown, which affected field position. Like, it just had all the goods. People have posted it a million times on Twitter or YouTube. So if you haven't seen it, go check it out. But that's because that's the freshest one in my mind, because of when we did it. It was fans reaching out, being like, hey, you got to take a look at this. And then, like I said, the visual, you're just looking at the score and the spread. Like, how the hell is this going to happen? How has this happened? and then a pick six on the last play of the game is how it happened. So it that's the one that sticks out to me for sure.
All right, I am not much of a gambler at all. I think my only wager on the books for this year is George Pickens, rookie of the year, plus 3,000. Do you like where I stand on that one?
As long as they keep a guy that's going to keep throwing them the football, yes, yeah. I do.
You're selling yourself short. You had a Bennett Skowronek making a catch in the Super Bowl.
That's true. Yeah, my last wager was Bennett Skowronek. Will he make a catch in the Super Bowl? I think it paid out in the first quarter. So it's like it was $10 nice. Richer right there.
is the dynamic change at all, Steve, with it being legal now? Like it used to be like a very niche following, especially on TV. It was like, wow, you're the I remember when I was at ESPN, like we were not allowed to reference lines or gambling when writing, and now it's like, how can you not do it?
Well, I think the frustrating thing has been somebody that's been doing it, and now you get, you know, why all the commercials? All right, why are they out there? Why is everybody, you know, DraftKings, FanDuel, whatever? It's to get the people that haven't bet involved and seeing, you know, free $100 if you put $100 on. All right, so it's not really free, but you're giving me $100. So maybe it is. It just gets people thinking. But the problem is I think about, you know, all these 18 parlays, and this guy says, oh, I hit seven of them, and this is a bad beat. I lost the eighth. And I'm like, he's like, I lost, you know, $25,000. I'm like, you didn't lose $25,000. You bet 50, so you lost 50. So, and then it's all the futures or championships that, hey, if you had this, you could have won this. All right, well, show me the person that had it. I don't like, I know what the odds were, but nobody had it. So, is it a story? No, I don't think it is. Was it a possibility? Yeah, but did it happen? No. So. What's the story there? It's just a thing to say, you know, well, look at me. And that's where it kind of gets tiresome, where there's so much of it going on with the online and states legalizing it, that it's kind of watered it down to me and made it frustrating of the possibility thing. Whereas show me the winner. I want to know somebody that won it, you know?
So if you're, I know you had mentioned sort of a, you're trying to figure out who the fourth team is. Like, if we had to put money on it, like, who would you put it on today?
Oof. You got to figure Pac-12, Big 12, or ACC, right? And the problem is the path. You've seen it with the ACC, with Clemson, you know? And that's where they're, when you look at the odds to make the playoff, they're the next team, right? So I mentioned those first three in Alabama, Ohio State, and Georgia. Clemson's the next highest, and I think it's because of familiarity. I would go, you know, off the bat. I'll tell you what else is a team that could be a top five team and stay there for a while if they go 2-0 is Pitt. Like, if Pitt blows the doors off of West Virginia and they beat Tennessee at Tennessee last year, they're not going to be afraid of Tennessee. If you want a flyer, like, way down the radar, I love what Pitt brings to the table defensively. Narduzzi is an absolute crazy person. You guys know that.
Yes.
And it gets in the way of his in-game situation sometimes. But Pitt is a team that's way down because I get it. They lost Addison and they lost Pickett. But I think Slovis is more than capable coming in. And I think Addison was more of a result of the other talent they got, they had at receiver. Like, I think Mario Williams is going to be the receiver at USC this year, not Addison. I think Mario Williams is going to put up bigger numbers. So I look at Pitt and what they bring back on both lines of scrimmage. I really like what they have there. So if you want a team way down there, I would say that. NC State's a team. I want to say Texas, but I don't think they can hold up defensively through the year. They're gonna change their defense. They say they're going to put more down guys, you know, in the box to help against the run. But I still think they're a year away from a roster standpoint where you need guys where you could rotate, you know, 7-8 guys on the D-line. They don't have that, but I love their offense. I think, I mean, playmaker-wise, they got guys all over the place. And I'm not sure the Big 12, and I mentioned how many one-score games there are. I don't think they have the build yet. I think this is a big year for them to take the next step and maybe get to eight, nine wins. But, and then probably Utah. Even though I like UCLA to win the Pac-12 that out of those tiers. I think UCLA has the goods to beat Utah. And if I out of those three, Utah, USC, UCLA, I'd get better odds and I would take UCLA.
Last one for me. I have a Heisman draft coming up here beyond later today, beyond the obvious. And frankly, outside of last year, they really have been mostly dark horses. Who are some long shots you think could factor into that race here?
Well, my mission this year is to get Michael Mayer to New York. That's the goal. So I'm looking for an odds maker to give me odds on Michael Mayer making it to New York, because I've so wanted to see a tight end go there. I look at a kid at Dillon Gabriel, who I absolutely loved at UCF. And, you know, we mentioned Ole Miss in the earlier, and one of the dynamics, I'm not sure about Ole Miss, because Jeff Lebby, their offensive coordinator, goes to Oklahoma. Jeff Lebby was offensive coordinator at UCF when Dillon Gabriel was a true freshman, and he just took off and ran. And I was blown away with what the kid did as a true freshman. And they still have enough pieces at the skill positions. I think, you know, they kept their O-line coach and beat him ball. They're going to be better. I think one of the best things about Lane Kiffin, and especially Lebby comboed last year, their offensive line wasn't great, but they coached around that and got the ball out and made defenses run sideline to sideline. And that gave them advantages in running situations later in the game. So Dillon Gabriel's a kid for sure. And then UCLA running back Zach Charbonnet is probably way down the board. But I think he's going to have a monster year for UCLA. So those are two. I mean, it's tough to go back to the running back, man. It's like the forgotten man in the sport now. But I think Charbonnet is a guy who could take on the load. The problem is wins are what these are all based on, right? You know, what is it? RG3 is the last quarterback to win with, or last player to win with three losses. I think that's right.
Lamar probably too, right there, right?
Okay, yeah. Lamar was. So it's a guy. I like a lot of the ACC quarterbacks. I don't know if they're going to win enough. Miami has a great chance this year. I still do think they're like Texas. They're a year away where they need more depth on the lines of scrimmage. But they have a great opportunity when they go to College Station week three. I'm fired up to see what they bring to the table, because – I know that fan base is starving to see something. So Dillon Gabriel is the one I gave out at the beginning of the summer, and I'll stick with him because I could see him putting up absolutely monster numbers.
All right, last
Mayer's okay. Plus 10,000. By the way, I'm at him right now. Get it while it's
put out. Put it in.
Throw that in there. Swan Mayer. Last time I think you were at an Notre Dame game, Mayer caught a ball off some poor linebacker's back. I want to know, like, will we see you at a Notre Dame game this year? Notre Dame at Burst Navy in Baltimore. Can we get Scott there for a little like Baltimore, Maryland food and drink recommendation?
That's definitely a pot. What is that, October?
It's November. It's late in the year. So,
ooh, okay. All right. No, that's definitely a possibility. I was hoping, actually, I have friends down in Chapel Hill, and I want to get down there, but I have a wedding I'm attending that weekend. So that is not there. I'm actually fired up for Notre Dame people. If I didn't go to Stanford, I was going to go to North Carolina and play for Mack Brown. And that, I mean, last time they didn't have fans, right? When Notre Dame went there and won with Ian
Book. Yeah, it was a COVID ad year. That's, 2020.
That's going to be an awesome, awesome atmosphere. That place is great. And that's why I think it's one of these sleeping giants where they just haven't gotten there. They've always had to play. You know, there was an elite team in front of them with Clemson a couple of years ago. And I go all the way back to Mac, you know, having to try and beat Florida State every year. So I Notre Dame fans, if you're going to that, be fired up for that. Chapel Hill is that's Raleigh, Chapel Hill, Durham. That's my favorite area of the country. That if you haven't been there, you should be fired up to go to that game. So I will put Notre Dame Navy on the calendar for sure. You guys,
November 12th.
All right.
It's even a noon start, so you can, you know, you got plenty of time to get on the air later.
Notre Dame Navy's a noon game. We'll get some crab cakes for breakfast. We'll be good to
perfect.
Go.
Perfect. November 12th. It's a date. We're on it.
Love it.
All right. Thanks, Steve.
Absolutely. Thank you, guys.